of Classical Studies from Vanderbilt, and there is the Director and Associate Professor for Classics and Mediterranean Studies. His initial training was in Michigan, and his first book he published was on Isthmia, the Roman and Byzantine Graves and Human Remains. And since then he has been doing quite a few things, apart from being the excavator of Kenchrea, as from 2002 to 2006, and then a new project where a second phase of exploration in Kenchrea is under his leadership in association with the American School. Last year we had the privilege of being guided through these excavation and the areas around Corinth by Joe Rife, and it is a very, very memorable experience, was it, with a lot of learning for us. So he is working on a second project where he will concentrate on funerary rituals, burial space, and mortuary commemoration for the elite in the Roman, in the Greek part of the Roman world, and we're looking forward to the publication of that. Of course, for this project, he is the archaeologist that helps us to find the traces of early Christianity in Achaia, and his expertise in the project is very, very appreciated. We look forward to listening to you, Joe.
Thank you. This is the microphone here, is that right? No, it's not on. Just project. Thank you. Exactly. Thank you very much for the kind invitation to speak here today. It's so wonderful to see good professional colleagues, personal friends. I had a wonderful time when I was at the last incarnation of this event a year and a half ago, and I'm so pleased to be back. And it's also, I should stress, wonderful to see so many friends and colleagues who work on the ground in Greece, in Attica, in the Peloponnese, in central Greece, here today. As in many parts of the Mediterranean world, the study of Christian burial in the region of Corinth is marked by a stark paradox. While death and burial were fundamental themes in Christian theology, narrative, symbolic representation, and while the Corinthia has been a region long and intensively examined by historians and archaeologists, the documentation of late Corinthian graves and our understanding of the relationship between ritual, society, and belief has advanced somewhat slowly. To be sure, the major tombs associated with the great urban churches have advanced, have been published in their architectural contexts, and our understanding of Christian epitaphs is greatly advanced thanks to the expertise of Dr. Sirinen. And yet, beyond brief mentions and reports, relatively little attention has been paid in the past to the numerous more mundane graves, many unmarked and unadorned, that Corinthians of lower status used in both the city and the countryside. The reasons for this somewhat primitive state of the field derive largely from the familiar biases of classical archaeology, the traditional concentrations on grand buildings in the city center, on the earlier phases of Greek history, on the institutional correlates of political and military life, and on public cult. I'm speaking, of course, here in broad brushstrokes. Furthermore, both the method and theory of mortuary archaeology, and I would add bioarchaeology, or the study of skeletal remains from archaeological contexts, in late antique Greece has not reached the high level it has achieved in other regions. We certainly do not possess the sort of richly detailed published record of burial and human remains that exists, for instance, for the prehistoric Americas or for Britain from Roman to Anglo-Saxon times. The good news is that the Corinthia, and indeed the broader region of the northeastern Peloponnese, provides, in my opinion, an excellent opportunity for examining ancient Christian burial from multiple perspectives. By my conservative estimate, we have published references to over 2,000 burials, though only a small fraction of these burials have been fully reported.
And many more burials have been excavated and documented, but remain unpublished. These graves were created within the topographic fabric of a well-known historic region, which allows us to consider how the mortuary landscape evolved in relationship to other functional spaces. Moreover, burials from across the region are reported around the urban hub in the peri-urban zone, in small rural settlements, in harbor towns, and even in apparent isolation in the countryside. And this mortuary record, despite the limitations of its size and the quality of its publication, clearly represents a diverse range of socioeconomic identities. My twin goals today, in the spirit of this workshop, are expository and exploratory. First, I will summarize briefly the current knowledge of Christian mortuary practice in the region, derived from my own research and the work of other researchers, chiefly Greek and American, over the past century, roughly. Then I will highlight certain themes that I consider ripe for exploration through collaborative study. This is, in other words, a sort of springboard for the broader program hosted here today. I present my observations as both an independent and a collaborative researcher for over 25 years in the region, including affiliations with both the excavations at Isthmia and Corinth, with the Eastern Carinthia Archaeological Survey, and since 2002 as the director for the American School at Kenkrei. I would note humbly that I have discussed many of these topics I'm addressing this morning already in my book, Isthmia 9, but since I completed that study in the early 2000s, I've discovered and analyzed more evidence from the Corinthian countryside and at Kenkrei, and my thinking has naturally evolved. I would also note that I conducted a cooperative excavation with Elena Korka, who is the Director of Antiquities in the Ministry of Culture of the Hellenic Republic, at Kenkrei in 2007 to 2009. That campaign uncovered important new evidence for burial in the late antique Corinthia, but since our results are still under editing for publication, I do not include them here today. I would only observe that the evidence from the Kutsungila Ridge, northeast of the harbor at Kenkrei, in many ways accords with my broader observations about the region as a whole. My discussion begins, as do many such synthetic discussions, with a crucial note about the time frame of investigation. We cannot identify any Corinthian burials as distinctly Christian from the first centuries of Corinthian Christianity, because burial in cemeteries was apparently not a preferred channel for self-presentation according to belief or practice until late antiquity. The complex reasons for this fall beyond the scope of my paper. Rather, the evidence for burial that I will survey dates to the 4th, 5th, to 7th centuries. In many cases, due to a lack of chronological indices from we cannot date graves any more precisely than late Roman / early Byzantine, distinguishing them from early / middle Roman burials, but not discriminating effectively between burials of, for instance, the Theodosian or the Justinianic eras. During this wide span of time, particularly from the 5th century onward, not only had Christianity achieved a position of broad institutional authority and participation in the Greek world, but Christian material and visual media, ecclesiastical architecture, iconography, epigraphic formulae, had developed into distinct and durable modes of cultural identification. Now, in a strict sense, without a tombstone or a lamp, for instance, we often cannot know for sure whether any one Corinthian grave of the 5th to 7th centuries belonged to a Christian or not. It does, however, seem reasonable to conclude that most Corinthian burials of that period did belong to Christians, or at least Corinthians, who to some degree, even partially or occasionally, participated in the rituals and absorbed the worldview of Christians. And those fewer burials that belonged to non-Christians, or even traditional polytheists, were sufficiently coherent in form and function with other burials in the region that they contribute to a full picture of the Corinthian mortuary environment during a time when the region was a Christian stronghold. And now I apologize.
Just use the arrows.
And now I have the little subscreen. There we go. Thank you. So I start with an overview of burial in the late antique Carinthia as derived from archaeological sources. I will proceed from the creation, design, and placement of the grave, not including in my discussion tombstones, to the because it's such a large and complex topic and it will be addressed variously by speakers later today. I will proceed on to the deposition of the body and other objects inside the burial compartment, and then I will address the dynamic processes of post-depositional disturbance. My aim here is merely to describe. I will turn to interpretive themes in a few moments. A plan of the immediate vicinity of Corinth, showing the Isthmus of Corinth, of course, the land bridge that connects central Greece with the southern peninsula of Greece, the Peloponnese, and some of the major sites. In the immediate vicinity of Corinth, I would say, however, that our evidence for the northeast burial in the northeastern Peloponnese, of course, extends much, much more broadly geographically into the eastern and western Carinthia. And we can learn a great deal, of course, by adopting a comparative perspective in looking at the very well compiled and documented burials from Argos. So I begin with burial location. We find that there are certain patterns in the location of burials, which I might summarize as following. First of all, late antique burials in the Carinthia and in the broader northeastern Peloponnese occur oftentimes in large and sprawling old burial grounds on the outskirts of settlements, which had been used for centuries, sometimes stretching all the way back to the classical era. And this is a plan of Corinth, the central area of Corinth, that shows, as indicated by the X's, the location of burials uncovered during excavation. You'll see a concentration, of course, around the northern edge of the ancient urban center, roughly following the natural landscape, the natural topography, the edge of a shelf of calcareous bedrock along the north side of the ancient city. And then you'll also see, of course, burials around the east, west, and south sides, to the south, of course, heading up the slope toward the citadel. Burials also occur in new burial grounds that covered, interrupted, abandoned, or destroyed zones in long-lived settlements, residential quarters, fortifications, sanctuaries, even commercial districts. This is a plan that shows in these various dots and circles interspersed with the architectural plan, the location of various late antique into early Byzantine burials in the area, of course, of the old Corinthian Forum. Burials also occur in and around church complexes, typically in burial annexes, but sometimes in the floors of the narthex or nave. And this is a plan of the eastern end of the Cranion Basilica to the east, in the Cranion district to the east of the old city center of Corinth. Sometimes, as I mentioned before, we also find that burials occur in apparent isolation in the countryside. Now, in such cases, we may reasonably propose that these burials belong to rural smallholders or workers on estates. We found several burials of this kind during the work of the Eastern Carinthia Archaeological Survey some 15 to 18 years ago. Burial arrangement, placement, and orientation. We find burials in large burial grounds, most often typically arrayed in rows, whether those are regularly planned rows or roughly traced. Sometimes we have cemeteries of this kind that are densely arranged, as you can see here. This is a section of a much larger cemetery just to the southeast of the Quadratus Basilica, the so-called Stikos Basilica on the northeastern edge of Corinth. We also have examples of burial grounds where the burials occur. They are arrayed in rows that are rather more sparse and uneven in their distribution. In terms of burial arrangement and placement, we find that some burials occur in areas of ruined buildings in such a way that they make use of pre-existing structures either for protection or for delimitation, such as earlier walls that might be used to form boundaries or to support covering elements. This is a picture of the interior face of the Hexamelian, the Theodosian, and then Justinianic curtain wall that was built across the isthmus, and these are some of the graves built right up alongside of it. I can highlight three interesting patterns, particular patterns of late antique burial among ruins, since I've just raised that topic. First of all, the occurrence of burials in old waterworks, particularly cisterns, spring houses, drains. These were memorable locales. People knew where they were. They're also subterranean oftentimes, and they were oftentimes protected large spaces, sometimes with a rectilinear plan. In other words, they provided a ready, assuming they were at the time out of use. They had fallen into disrepair. They provided a ready compartment for burial. A second pattern, interesting pattern in the placement of late antique burials among ruins. The creation of a burial, an interment, in the concrete foundation of a former pagan temple, typically cut into the facade or around the tikobate or the stylobate of the former structure. We have examples of this, for instance, at Isthmia, at the site of the Palaemonium, which was the shrine to the hero Polymon. This particular version of that shrine, it was a monopteros, a circular tholos-style building on a small scale, but precious nonetheless, richly decorated. This is the Antonine version of the temple that was reused in the probably late 5th or early 6th century as a kind of, and we'll talk about this in a moment, as a kind of a funerary monument, and an interment you'll see was placed directly into the sod, right alongside the descent that went into the foundation courses of the building. We also have examples of the same phenomenon in some of the buildings on the western edge of the Corinthian Forum, the old Corinthian Forum. A picture looking, let's see, west across the temple platform of the Asclepieion on the northern side of Corinth, and you can see all of the late antique burial shafts of a type that we'll talk about in just a moment here, cut down again into the limestone bedrock that forms the temple platform, both in the robbed out foundation trench of the northern, I believe this is the northern wall of the temple, and then of course outside, and not so much inside, but there are a few there along the edge of the terrace. A third pattern that we might recognize in the location of late antique burials among ruins is burial in long since defunct chamber tombs of early Roman date. In these cases, crosses were inscribed or painted on the interior walls, and bodies of the recently deceased were added either directly into old burial compartments, inside newly made burial compartments, or they were simply deposited on the floor. And here we have examples of both inscribed crosses and then also painted crosses. Naturally difficult to date such decoration, but when you can combine that evidence with artifactual evidence, stratigraphic evidence, deposits from the floors of such chamber tombs, then you can make the case more effectively. In terms of the orientation of burials, typically they were, and this is a consistent pattern, oriented with the heads of the deceased in the west and the feet in the east. Even when such an orientation, the eastward orientation, contradicts the existing physical conditions or alignments of ruined buildings. It's hard to talk about patterns, and it's hard to talk about patterns and at the same time strike or achieve a level of, let's say, statistical significance in quantifying the number of occurrences of certain phenomena. So I talk mostly impressionistically, let's say, based on my experience with the evidence, both firsthand and through publications, when I talk about patterns. It does seem, however, that many, if not most, late antique graves contained multiple burials. These can be plausibly interpreted as extended families or perhaps households using the same burial locale over an extended period of time, even crossing generations. This is supported in various ways archaeologically, but also, I would add, by the evidence of skeletal biology, such as the concurrence of congenital traits that show up in the surviving hard tissues of the individuals in such multiple burials. Large graves or tomb chambers. And here we have a large built grave on the left. This comes from the area of the northeast gate at Isthmia. Contained as many as 10 to 15 or more individuals, typically men, women, and children. These are commonly documented. When such multiple burials occur, the skeletonized remains of pre-existing skeletons, that is to say, after the soft tissues have deteriorated, have decomposed to such an extent that the bones can actually be manually disarticulated. Typically, the skeletonized remains were moved to one side to accommodate the placement of the recently deceased in the burial. For those folks, and there are several of you in the audience who have excavated late antique burials, this is a common occurrence. You've all encountered examples of multiple levels of burials, stratified burials, in which the earlier burials, in the earlier burials, the bones have been moved to one side along the wall or perhaps up to the end of the cist, the burial compartment. Relatively few, and again, I'm not going to talk in terms of statistical significance or sort of starkly quantified evidence, but it seems that relatively few late antique graves contain single burials, and it's perhaps significant, this is a hypothesis which we need to test with more evidence, that these seem to have occurred more frequently in smaller or rural settlements than in the larger urban settlements. Okay, let's talk about grave design. We can classify the burial types in the late antique Corinthian many different ways. But I would propose a typology that, in a sense, is ranked from the most monumental to the most mundane, but also from the rarest, that is the most monumental, to the most commonly occurring, the most frequently occurring, that is the more mundane variety. We may start with churches or martyria associated with holy figures, whether they're saints or martyrs or leaders in the early Christian community in the region. These are themselves, of course, both commemorative buildings and places of worship, such as those buildings which traditionally have been attributed to Saints Leonidas and Codratus. Then we have elaborate chambers with entryways, with descending stairways, down to large burial compartments with a visible structure above ground. These are chiefly found around churches, but sometimes in other prominent locales, such as in the former Corinthian Forum. We find rectangular chambers or cists that are built from brick and rubble, finished inside with marble revetments or plaster, and covered evenly with slabs or tiles, some of which may have been, in fact, purpose-made. These kinds of elaborate cist burials, I would call them, are relatively rare. Here's an example of one on the left. Now, there's a type of burial that is, I would say, typically Corinthian. It's not widely frequently occurring across the region, but we have documented several examples of it. And I don't have a good name for it, apart from calling it something like an oblique shaft grave. These are, those of you who are familiar with Corinthian archaeology, of course, will immediately recognize them. These are spacious burial compartments that are cut obliquely at an angle into the bedrock, whether down into a flat, down from a flat surface or a sloping surface, or actually at an angle into a vertical surface, like a vertical exposure of limestone. Such graves had an interior chamber that was distinct. Here's an example of one that's cut down directly into the bedrock. Here's another one that is cut at an angle. You can see the section, which is actually turned perpendicular to the field of view. I apologize for that. You can see it's cut at an angle down into a slope. These graves typically had an interior chamber that was distinctly defined, and often they had an elaborate facing or covering of slabs, rubble, and mortar. Sometimes these coverings over these oblique shaft graves were actually fashioned out of plaster, mortar, rubble, to look like a sort of small bed, perhaps a cline, oftentimes with a cross inscribed on top. There are examples from Isthmia. We've documented examples in the Corinthian countryside. And there are examples, and I've left out the picture here, that are well known from the excavations in the late 60s by Jim Weissman in the area of the Sleepy Eon, Lerna Hollow, and the gymnasium. Finally, we have several forms of burial that occur very commonly. Again, unmarked and unadorned. Simple cists with partial or no walling, flooring, or covering. Very common, sometimes partial covering. With tiles here, this is an undisturbed grave, so the condition of the tile covering is as it would have been made by mourners. Simple cists covered with tiles in a gabled arrangement. And then I don't have an illustration of this, but burials in vessels, especially amphoras or large water jars that were broken open at the shoulder or split in half. These are especially burials in vessels are especially common in the city for use in the burial of children. The position of the body, corporeal arrangement. The deceased are invariably interred in a supine position with the legs and upper arms extended, but the arms flexed, bent over the chest, sometimes crossing, or covering the abdomen or the waist. In some cases, it seems clear that the feet were pulled together, though we cannot know for certain whether or not they were bound to presumably facilitate the transport of the body to the grave. The heads were most often positioned facing forward, sometimes with stones or tiles added to help hold the head in place, to support the head from behind, sometimes underneath the chin, presumably to hold the mandible, which over time with the decomposition of the flesh will open up in a sort of unattractive, gaping expression. Of course, after burial, the skull often settled to one side or the mandible detached from the cranium proper. Funerary artifacts. Late antique Corinthians left a variety of objects with the deceased. I would classify these into three general categories. Many were personal adornments, including a wider range of earrings, finger rings, necklaces with beads and pendant crosses, like this example, brooches, pins, things that are pinned to garments, or attachments such as small bells, tintinnabula. Other personal accessories included utilitarian articles of dress, such as pins, possibly hairpins or even clothing pins, buckles, buttons, and even studded footwear, right, hobnails. Sometimes, but not as a rule, mourners also left symbolic or ritual objects in the grave with the dead. These included coins on the face, in the mouth, or over the chest, and vessels for serving and consuming, perhaps sprinkling, liquid, including what are commonly called, to use the classical term, lekythoi, these cylindrical or piriform vessels, right? Oil vessels. Often pitchers and cups or mugs. These were oftentimes left around the legs or the head. Sometimes mourners often left symbolic sometimes mourners also left symbolic or ritual objects outside the grave, especially lamps, though these do not commonly occur inside graves. Unguentaria, small vessels for ointments or aromatic substances, are relatively rare in late antique graves. These occur both inside and outside of the burial compartments. These are just some examples of late antique lamps from burials at Kenkrei. In studying these burials, we are naturally struck by the intensely intimate proximity of living mourners to dead bodies in varying stages of decomposition. The burial event itself was, of course, a close encounter, emotionally charged, between the living and the dead. But thereafter, too, people interacted with human remains in a variety of ways, beginning, as we've noted, with the movement of skeletonized remains around the burial compartment to accommodate the addition of new bodies. I've identified two other discrete scenarios for post-depositional interaction with the dead. Secondary burial, or the displacement of skeletal and burial remains from one site to another. This was often required, of course, when earlier graves were accidentally disturbed, such as during construction, or when familial remains were being consolidated at a new burial site. Oftentimes, of course, we cannot diagnose the motivation for the creation of a secondary burial. Typically, secondary burial occurred on the scale of a single grave here or there and not in the wholesale displacement of cemeteries. Here, as a footnote, I would observe that the well-known practice of collecting mass secondary burial deposits in chambers, ostia thecae, or ostia fulacia, as they're sometimes called, does not seem to have begun, at least in my observations, before the Byzantine centuries. Archaeologists have in the past misidentified deposits of commingled human bones and teeth found in chamber tombs as late antique ostia thecae, whereas in some cases at least, it seems that these were created by grave robbing after antiquity, the commingling of remains as bones were being moved around in the destructive hunt for valuable grave objects. The best evidence for ostia thecae appended to churches does not seem to predate roughly, although this is again an area for further study, the Middle Byzantine period. Now, a second poorly understood but apparently widespread practice of post-depositional interaction with the dead, as I've called it, was the conscientious extraction of one or a few bones from earlier Christian graves. This is a picture of an early Roman, early Middle Roman burial compartment. Sorry, I'm stepping back for a moment. An early to Middle Roman burial compartment, probably in the 2nd to 3rd centuries, with human remains of that date that has been completely rifled through and largely destroyed by grave robbing, probably in several phases beginning around the 6th to 7th centuries, creating what looks like a major secondary deposit of bones, but what is in fact a highly fragmentary and commingled bone bed, as Tophonimus would call such a deposit, a bone bed. Well, to return, one poorly understood, and just to repeat myself here for clarity, one poorly understood but apparently widespread practice was the conscientious extraction of one or a few bones from earlier Christian graves. This seems to have occurred most often during the Middle Byzantine period, let's say from the 10th century onward, when builders unearthed an unknown grave, unexpectedly, right, of late antique date, some 400 to 800 years old, let's say, at the time. Then they would move around those accidentally disturbed bones within the grave, if, for instance, they were sinking the foundation courses of a wall. They would move the accidentally disturbed bones around in an orderly and respectful fashion. But they would also remove, for instance, one long bone, a femur, a humerus, one innominate, this is the one half of the pelvic girdle, or hand or foot bones, tractable elements, in other words, with surprisingly careful precision so as to leave the rest of the articulated skeleton intact. And here we have examples of a femur that's been lifted and placed up here. You can see there was a foundation trench that completely destroyed the lower legs from the mid-femur downward. You can see the right innominate has been removed carefully, while other bones have been completely left intact. And this is a more exceptional case where almost with surgical precision, the left humerus has been removed. The bones, right, not the tarsals, but rather the metatarsals and the phalanges of the right foot have been removed, leaving the ankle bones in place, very hard to do. So I understand. And I think that's the limit of the disturbance of that grave, but this is the kind of phenomenon that, of course, is hard to identify if in the exploration of the graves there is no, let's say, osteological knowledge. that is applied to understanding the arrangement of the human remains. I'm not going to explore this practice further today, but I would note several possible explanations. The collection of mementos in a culture where handling human remains was not reviled but rather celebrated, particularly the remains of individuals of special status, special for their antiquity, or perhaps there was a perceived ancestral connection to these graves. Perhaps the collection of articles for distribution on the market for relics. Very interesting questions that this kind of patterning raises. Well, in the interest of time, I'm going to move quickly here to highlight a few important themes for interpreting this copious evidence for Christian burial in the late antique Corinthia. My aim this morning is not to explain the mortuary record per se, long-term project that I initiated already in my book, Isthmia 9, but rather to propose certain fruitful perspectives from which to view this copious mortuary record. In doing so, I apply an underlying conception of the burial remains as material components of meaningful and orderly, or ritual, behaviors within a particular social, economic, and religious context in time and space. First perspective, social structure. Through funerary ritual, mourners generated a memory of the deceased as a member of a community in which individuals were defined both by their relative status and by their enmeshed relationships. Thus, we can trace in mortuary variability across the region, to a certain extent, the internal social variability of communities. In other words, we can investigate who were the elites and non-elites, i.e., what was the degree of vertical differentiation, and how were they separated by group membership, if at all. Right, horizontal differentiation. What were the emblems of status and group membership, if there were any? We can observe, I would suggest, a disproportionate, even lavish investment in monumental tomb design and numerous costly burial goods and garments in the case of local elites, particularly in the case of prominent members of Christian congregations, whether clerics or not, who were interred around the grand basilica churches. We think of course, the famous example of the bishop in the Codratus Basilica, Eustathius, I believe, right, with the libation tube. In contrast, we can observe the relative homogeneity of non-elite burials across the region in terms of investment in design and content. Admittedly, we can only rely on the physical remains of burial to explore social structure, ephemeral experiences, and non-durable media, singing, praying, recitations, conversations, food, garments, smells. All of these might have served to distinguish the dead within their communities. In any case, based on the archaeological evidence, we must wonder whether the broadly similar treatment of non-elite burials, in terms of location, arrangement, design, composition, reflected in certain communities, particularly farming villages, perhaps an egalitarian organization of life and work. We may even wonder whether the similar treatment of non-elite burials, and here I'm far out in the world of speculation, reflects the power of burial as a leveling mechanism, a Christian ideology wherein personal differences were subsumed beneath, on the one hand, a rejection of earthly splendor, and on the other, the hope for a salvation from above. Apart from the burials of elites and non-elites, it's also worth considering those individuals whose unusual status called for burial in separation from the broader community, either to honor or to exclude. We've already noted the exceptional interments of clergy or other holy personae. We may also note the differential treatment of very young children who died before developing a significant familial or social identity, and thus often appear in single burials, and apparent criminals or victims of violent crime, the placement and position of whose bodies do not conform to prevailing mortuary convention. Their bodies are thrown down, for instance, wells, or their bodies are twisted in unusual, disorderly ways in graves that otherwise appear to be rubbish dumps. As a corollary to any consideration of social structure, we should examine mortuary variability according to the context of settlement. How did graves differ in rural versus urban contexts, in cosmopolitan versus traditional, for lack of a better term, communities. And what does that tell us about social, economic, and religious differences between those communities? I've already noted an apparent trend toward conformity among burials in smaller or rural communities, as opposed to perhaps a trend toward concerted variety among burials in larger or more diverse urban communities. We may reasonably ask whether an impulse to self-identify as Christian or any other identity in death was stronger in populous Corinth than it would have been in a hamlet in the countryside. I conclude here with a third perspective from which to view the mortuary record of late antique Corinthia, and that is the relationship to the past. In considering the historical setting of late antique Corinthian burial, a fundamental question is the impact of Christianity, of course, on funerary ritual. Which innovations in burial appear over time? Which practices become more patterned or prominent in such a way that we can propose to identify them as expressions of a Christian identity? One of these is, of course, the veneration of the holy dead, as we see in the case of Agios Quadratos, which involved not only visitation and viewing of the site of burial, but also the accumulation of pious burials in the vicinity. Another obvious change is the ubiquity of the cross, which recalled the catistic story of Christ's sacrifice, but also communicated the message of life through death. Another consistent development in mortuary practice over time was the more systematic interment of bodies, so as to face the east, and in an orderly or controlled position on their backs with their arms engaged, flexed, in preparation for the divine judgment to come, or embodying the metaphor of death as quiet repose or a blissful sleep. Second important consideration under this larger topic of the relationship to the past is burial in a landscape with profound cultural memory. Sometimes mourners place graves inside or alongside pre-existing monuments, including the venerable sites of pagan cult. And they did so with deliberate consideration for the former building's design and topographic setting. In such cases, we should not simply conclude that mourners were making convenient use of available space and building materials. Certainly practical concerns were on the minds of many bereaved families in that difficult time of losing a loved one. But we should also consider how locating a grave prominently in a defunct shrine that in some cases might have operated into a rather late date, 3rd or 4th century, either appropriated the grandeur of that monument and accommodated its former significance, or violated its sanctity to claim ownership or assert superiority. These are questions that can be asked. A related important question concerning the historical development of burial is how older pre-Christian practices persisted well beyond the phase of Christian ascendancy. Apotropaic devices were still used to repel malevolent or destructive agents, the sign of the cross, of course, but we also find magical phylacteries in late antique burials. We have a good example from Kenkrei. The tools of libation to nourish the spirit were still left. Tokens of monetary sacrifice or symbolic tolls, coins, were still deposited on the body. The funerary banquet may still have been a focal point for the community of survivors, although the evidence for that is not entirely clear. Such mortuary conservatism was not intentionally subversive, I don't think. It reflects the ongoing relevance and potency of such old practices to assuage the pain of bereavement and to connect with the lost beloved. And it reminds us how late antique communities could adopt a new institutional orthodoxy, in a broad sense, at the high level of ecclesial authority, while at the grassroots level, they embrace the efficacy of the traditional ways, even when those ways may have historically implied a different eschatology of an arduous journey to the underworld. Well, after that theoretical discussion, I will end with a simple exhortation, since so many of us conduct fieldwork in Southeastern Europe, and in the Greek world, we need complete and careful publications of late antique burials, both those newly excavated and also those legacy data that were discovered years ago. These burials can be very informative as sources for social and religious history. Thanks so much for your patience. It was a little bit long. Hi, Rebecca.
Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you.
A comment and a question, if that's all right.
Very
quick comment is, I find it always ironic that there was this great opening up of tombs and abuse of tombs when all the so many of the inscriptions on tombs curse the people who are going to do that. So you can see why it was necessary to do that. At the KMF
Excellent
Cemetery
point.
In Knossos, the Knossos Medical Faculty Cemetery that
yes.
was excavated in rather rushed circumstances,
yes.
they the data there was showing up many family burials which consisted of man and two male and two females and children. And we concluded as a result of that it was likely because of women dying in childbirth and that they would be included in those family burials. Mm. And I wondered if you had something similar in the Carinthia, but also what we're seeing in Knossos is more concern for the inclusion of children in burials than we had in the earlier period. And so I was curious about your proposal that there was more children burials outside than there were, and maybe that happened in an earlier phase rather than in a later phase. Because I think in Lerna Hollow, don't you have many more children burials in
there
Lerna
are.
Hollow?
Yes, there are. That's absolutely
in
right.
In the tombs.
Yeah. Thank you for the excellent point about the disturbance of graves, which seems to have been, you know, such an uncommon occurrence that it, of course, provokes this epitaphic outburst of curses against disturbance. Right. Excellent point, and thank you so much to share the evidence from the medical faculty site, right, at Knossos.
Yeah.
you know, I think there's a lot to say. It's so, as you yourself know so well, Dr. Sweetman, you know, working with this mortuary evidence is very challenging because oftentimes you're confronted with the shortcomings of the published record, and I mean that completely respectfully. It's just a reality that we struggle with. And we find that, you know, compiling a picture of a region is in and of itself difficult, but takes a tremendous amount of effort, and then moving beyond that and looking at the sort of fine grain, the fine resolution variability that exists across space in very different areas is, you know, it almost represents a whole different project. So that is all simply a sort of a sharing of thoughts about the kind of business we're in. I think the truth is that there's probably a tremendous amount of small-scale variation that has been lost in the study of these burials from not just site to site within regions, but also between large regions. And so this is all to say that, you know, I can't answer precisely how the evidence from Knossos relates to what we're seeing in the Carinthia. I think that specifically now, moving from the abstract to the concrete, I think that the question of the burial of children, I think this may be a point of differentiation, as I was implying and talking about different interpretive perspectives, between urban and rural. And this may be a phenomenon that is more common in the urban setting for various reasons, whether it has to do with the practicalities of burial in an overpopulated setting, or it has to do with the concern to create a family burial group in a much more densely populated and diverse community, right? Whereas in some of the rural sites that we've investigated, including those we found in the Eastern Corinthian Archaeological Survey, but also the small community at Isthmia, it seems like the integration of children from a certain age into multiple burials is somewhat uncommon, and oftentimes they're sort of set apart into individual graves or single graves. What that means, they're not quite they're not quite full participants in the productive socioeconomic unit of the family in the context of an agrarian village. That might be one explanation. I'm not entirely sure, or perhaps they're seen as more precious and therefore worthy of individual burial. These are possible explanations, but I think that maybe some of the differentiation, apart from general differences between regional practices within regions, may reflect differences between urban and rural settings and the essential social and economic differences between those communities. I don't know if that is a start for a conversation later, probably.
Hello, on the topic of child burials.
Yeah.
So, for example, in Sovi, we have in the 6th century settlement, which is quite unusual, underneath the floor levels, on the top floor levels, in the settlement a lot of children burials. So
right.
In the past 10 years of excavations, we can say that we have a lot, but we can say,
right.
I'm not sure about the number, probably around 10 or 11 children burials.
Okay. Like,
and some of them are actually infants that probably died before even like seeing the light of day. So maybe maybe even born dead.
Yes.
So I was wondering if you have any idea about that phenomenon, and if you have any samples or examples from any other sites on in Greece or anywhere in the vicinity of the Balkans.
Oh boy, great question. Do the burials? This is in Stobi. Do the burials appear as let's say groups of children, or are they clustered in any way, or it's the presence of these young child burials?
In different places.
It's always only one.
Always only one in a room. Let's say there's not. I don't think that there is a couple of rooms with burials next to each other.
Right.
So it's different areas of the site, but it's always in houses. So it's always underneath.
In houses.
People. Yes.
Right. Wow. I can't say off the top of my head, but I'm definitely going to think about it. It's an excellent question. We do find, are these children? Has there been some osteological analysis to age, to determine the age of death? Are these like newborns, or are they older
mostly,
children? Or
they're mostly newborns, but I have to say that it hasn't been done yet.
I mean,
there is an anthropologist working on it right now, so we'll probably have to wait for reports so that we could say the exact age of the infants.
There does say in general, and I won't cite any specific evidence, but there does seem to be in general a pattern of, for newborn burials, if they're not placed in the burial of the parents, right, that there seems to be a greater latitude, let's say, or fluidity for burial placement. Maybe because they're not seen as biologically and socially fully matured, that they're still sort of a part of the world of nature, if you will, if they've just emerged from the mother, right? And we do find, and I could look up some examples at least, of infant burials in wells and cisterns where they've clearly simply been disposed without, let's say, some kind of formal or conventional burial, right? But it's an interesting question to find them underneath homes. So we can think more about that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, maybe Rebecca knows. Or Amelia, maybe.
I don't know, Christina, if you remember, but I think there's some burials like that are left there now. That Chrissy has worked on. We don't remember, but I have a reference for it, so I'll send it.
Thank you so much.